I'll call the meeting to order. This meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01, which is posted online. Mr. Smith, would you conduct a roll call, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Sundin is present. Vice Chair Vang.
Present.
Representative Anderson.
Present.
Anderson present. Burkle.
Present.
Burkle present. Eklund.
Present.
Eklund present. Hansen R.
Hansen R. present.
Hansen R. present. Hansen J. is excused for now. Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Cleavorn present. Lippert.
Lippert present.
Lippert present. Lewitt.
Lewitt present.
Present. Miller.
Present.
Miller present. Nelson.
Present.
Nelson present. And Thompson. Not yet. We do have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Vice Chair Vang, I'm assuming you reviewed the minutes of the previous meeting. What's your pleasure?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the minutes for the meeting of January 27th, 2021.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing and seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, say nay. Okay, thank you. The motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Just a little overview of the agenda. Today, we're going to begin our detailed walkthrough of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture budget, beginning with a number of divisions in protection services. It's important to get a good understanding of the budget that we're charged with developing. There should be time for questions, so please use the raise hand and we can get started. The detailed budget narrative was provided to members and posted in advance of the meeting, along with the PowerPoint presentation from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Program Review. Who's going to start off? Mark Abrahamson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Happy to be here. My name is Mark Abrahamson. I'm the director of the Plant Protection Division. So I'll go through and give you some information. Bring the slides up. All right. Okay. So if you can advance the slides. Okay. Yeah, thank you. All right, so here is a budget overview for the Plant Protection Division. So for fiscal year 22-23, budget is about $20 million, of which about half is from fees and about 30% from the general fund and then 20% from federal grants. Go ahead and advance the slides, please. So Plant Protection Division, we work with kind of a wide variety of industries and stakeholders, but if you think about what we do, it kind of falls into three areas. Number one, our work helps to facilitate fair and transparent marketplaces. So truth in labeling, good quality products, free of insects and disease, that sort of thing. Big part of that then is also protecting our resources from invasive species. So that kind of goes hand in hand with the work we do with industries, but then also detection surveys for invasive species and mitigation work to manage them. And then finally, providing Minnesota plants and plant products with access to marketplaces. And so all those things kind of tie together. So many times when a farmer needs to move a plant or a plant product to another country or sometimes even to another state, they need some certification that the plant or the product meets some standards, and we provide those for many industries. Okay, next slide, please. So like I said, it's a wide variety of things. We work with grain elevators in terms of their buying of grain and storage. Work to certify seed potatoes. We license hemp producers. We oversee seed labeling for, again, the truth in labeling. We certify nursery stock as free from insects and disease. We provide grading services for fruit and vegetable transactions. We issue phytosanitary certificates, so that's that need to certify conditions are met before movement to another country or state. And then we work with invasive species, plant protection, plant pest detection, mitigation, noxious weed management. And then for us, a little bit of an oddball, we pay wolf and elk depredation claims. And then we also have a program that grants money to livestock producers to take preventative measures against wolf depredation. So a wide variety of things. So I'll be happy to answer questions on any of those programs, but I'm just gonna go into detail on a few of them in the interest of time. So if you could advance the slide, please. So I'll talk quite a bit about our noxious weed program. We have a change item in for our noxious weed budget. And so the basics of the noxious weed program is we manage the noxious weed list, and we work with local governments to ensure that weeds are managed according to that list. So noxious weed list has different classifications. So the worst weeds are prohibited and need to be eradicated. A little bit less worse or more widespread are prohibited, but just have to be controlled from spreading. So kept from going to seed. And then some plants can be present on the ground, but not be sold. They're restricted. So the noxious weed list is maintained by us, and we work with the Noxious Weed Advisory Committee. So it's a great group. It's made up of a bunch of agency partners and stakeholder groups, and they advise us on the management of the program, and in particular on the listing of weeds. And then, as I said, we work really closely with local governments to bring the weed law to the ground. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so the noxious weed program went through a budget bottleneck in the early 2000s and was pretty much not much left of it. But in the 2010s, we kind of began bringing it back together through a series of pilot projects that were funded by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. So one of the first ones, this elimination of target invasive plants, was really meant to go after the worst weeds, the prohibited eradicate species that were present in Minnesota, and try and get some work on the ground to manage and eradicate. So this is a couple of pictures of work done on Oriental bittersweet. So that was one of the species. And this is a good project in that it got a lot of ground weed work done, but also it was really great in the types of property owners working collaboratively or cooperatively on weed management. So weeds, of course, don't care about property ownership boundaries. So through this project, we worked on public land and were able to be really effective in that way. If you advance the slide, please. And this was really helpful in that it also allowed us to develop kind of a model of weed management that we were able to bring to bear when Palmer amaranth showed up in Minnesota. So by that point, we had pretty much worked out the mechanisms of how do you do these weed control programs on multiple different types of land ownership. And so we were able to hit the ground running with Palmer amaranth, and the results have paid big dividends. The graph shows the blue bars are the cumulative sites where Palmer has been confirmed in fields. We're up to about 30 fields. But what's left on we've done is we've got four sites we're managing going into 2021, and three of those showed up in 2020. So very effective. And really one of the really incredible things about Palmer is how early people are finding it. And so we're from producers, from crop consultants, when there are just a few plants out in a field and they're finding them. And that has given us an excellent opportunity to get in there and nip these in the bud. So we've been able to be really aggressive with this weed and keep it under wraps. And we hope to keep it that way for a long time. If you could advance the slide. And there's a number of other weeds too that are different from Palmer in that they have a bigger foothold in Minnesota, but we've really been able to ramp up the work so that we're doing a lot better job of finding where they are. And so knotweeds are a good example. They're on the prohibited control list. And then poison hemlock, which is one of our prohibited eradicate species. There's just a lot of weeds out there that were not known, and if we don't know they're there, we can't take steps to get them managed. So we had a lot of success in weeds like this, just in terms of like getting a better handle of where they are, and then the management can start to catch up and reduce those acres. So Palmer's been great in terms of how early it's been found, but other weeds were making progress on them as well. If you could advance the slide. That's where another aspect of the program is really going to help us going into the future. I mean, if you think about it, it can be kind of overwhelming with all these species and all the acres that they occur on. And so we really need a way to help us focus our efforts in the place we're going to have the biggest bang for the buck. And so this tactical invasive plant management plan, this was another pilot project funded by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And working with the university and other partners, we've got now a quantitative decision model that we can use to help guide weed control efforts in different regions of the state. So in different regions, different weeds are our bigger priority based on factors such as how common they are, the opportunities to control them, economic considerations. And so this is a quantitative model that just completed in the last year and is really going to help us to further make sure that we're putting any dollars for weed management to the best possible use. Okay, if we could advance the slide, please. And we have had dollars to put towards weed management over the last two bienniums. So in fiscal year 18 and 19, we had $600,000 that was appropriated from the general fund and granted out to local governments for weed control projects. In fiscal year, that should be 20 and 21, or yeah, it's 20 through 22. A three-year project, money appropriated from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, $650,000, again, to grant out to local governments for weed control. We've got all of about $80,000 left to grant out that we're in the process of getting out now for this coming field season. And to date, we've funded 99 projects, and you can see the acres of noxious weed management that are occurring are really growing and growing more rapidly as we go into the future. So you can advance the slide. So our ask for this biennium, for the fiscal year 2021 biennium, we had $450,000 appropriated per fiscal year to fund noxious weed program at the Department of Ag. And that appropriation was written to be reduced to $225,000 per fiscal year, starting in the coming biennium fiscal year 22-23. What we're asking is to keep the funding at $450,000 per fiscal year ongoing. So what that money has allowed us to do specifically, the $225,000, is during this past biennium, we brought on three people who work in two in southern Minnesota and one in northern Minnesota, and they're working on the ground with local governments to provide expertise, coordination, advice on these weed control programs. And so they've been pretty instrumental to our success in these areas. And in particular, our Palmer amaranth expert who goes all over the state whenever Palmer amaranth is reported or found in fields, he's one of those people too. So we feel like they've been pretty critical to our success. And so we're asking to keep the funding at $450,000 per fiscal year. We feel like we've got a lot of momentum, we're getting a lot done, and we've got the tools in place to continue getting a lot done in the noxious weed program. Okay, so that's everything for noxious weeds. The other program I wanted to highlight was hemp. And so what we do for hemp is we're licensing producers and handlers of raw hemp. As part of that, it's very important that we're tracking anywhere the hemp is being grown, is being stored, is being processed, because we get calls pretty regularly from law enforcement asking about sites and whether it is a legal hemp grower or not. And so it's very important that we're tracking all that information. And then also, to date, we've been responsible for sampling and analyzing every single lot of hemp. And so that's every variety that each grower is producing, having them analyzed for THC content. So there's a ton of data that we're taking and managing. And it's really important data because the THC content determines whether someone has a crop that they're going to be allowed to use and sell, or it's something they have to destroy. So it's critical that we're keeping all of these data organized and managed and usable. Next slide, please. Hemp production has increased a lot. And so from 2018 to 2019, there was a huge jump. Part of that was hemp was federally legalized at the end of 2018. And then the kind of the compounding factor is that there was the emergence of this market for cannabinoids, CBDs, that was kind of occurring at the same time. And a lot of people saw an opportunity to get in on this new crop. So we had a huge increase in 2019, and that's pretty much continued for 2020 with a big interest in growing hemp. Next slide, please. Like I said, the THC content is really important. We've had over the last 2 years, about 9 to 10% of the lots that have been tested have failed and have had to be destroyed. These are generally the cannabinoid varieties that are being grown for CBD content. But it's a big deal for the growers who are growing those crops and if they then can't, you know, realize any return from them. So it's been a big concern. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, big things have been happening in hemp. So up through the end of 2020, we were operating as a pilot program, which had been allowed through the Farm Bill. As of January 1st, 2021, we've transitioned into operating a fully recognized hemp program under USDA's oversight. So we have a plan that's approved by USDA in terms of how we're operating the program, and that took effect January 1st. Just about as soon as that happened, there was amended federal rules that were published. The good thing is that they're improved pretty much you know, across the board. And so we're now in the process of clarifying the changes with USDA and planning changes to our state plan as well, which we'll be rolling out as we're able to, you know, under the USDA timeline here going into the spring. A few good things. The new rules, the sampling requirements are a bit more practical from the USDA end. We aren't necessarily going to have to sample every single lot. We can sample a random subset as long as we're ensuring we have the data to show that we're not at risk of missing crops that would be failing. The other thing is they've defined a sampling method, which takes a little bit more of the plant in terms of the sample unit, and probably could result in fewer failures as well for producers. So those will be good things. One thing that's important is we need to share our data with USDA on a monthly basis. So all of the data that we're collecting and managing, we have to have in a format that we can pass on to USDA. Next slide, please. Okay, and so this is our ask. We have a change item in for hemp also. We're asking for a one-time appropriation of $50,000. We've done a lot of work over the past year or so on online licensing for producers and then a system for us to manage all of their data, including the testing information. We've made a lot of progress with that. We're very close to having it done. We just need a little bit more work on it to get some of the last few issues ironed out. And, you know, hemp production is, it's a new market. Users are producers are paying pretty significant fees already. We don't feel like it's really fair to ask them to kick in more money to try to get this across the finish line. So we're asking for a one-time appropriation of $50,000 to help us bring that development to a conclusion. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, just a few things I wanted to mention from 2020 that were interesting. Probably all of you heard about the mystery seeds. This was a really weird thing. I remember when I heard about it, I was in a call with a bunch of other states on another topic on a Friday afternoon, and it was news to me. Next Friday, we had taken about 500 calls from people in Minnesota who had received these seeds. So it all kind of hit at once. As you maybe saw in the news, this was called a brushing scam, where basically internet sellers ship a product and then create a fake review. It's kind of a weird thing to me, but that's the explanation for it. We ended up getting over 800 reports in Minnesota of people who got seeds they didn't order. The great thing was just about everybody sent those packages to us. We were able to get them collected and ultimately destroyed. USDA and also MDA, we spent some time going through the seeds. They were generally innocuous types, herbs, flowers, shrubs. But even so, seeds that are not going through a regular process have the potential to carry insects, pathogens. And so we didn't want them to be planted, and they were destroyed as they should have been. And changes were made to limit the potential for that to happen in the future. Okay, next slide, please. Number of invasive species things that came up this year. A really big one was Ralstonia solanacearum. That is a pathogen that can move in geraniums. It's actually a pest of solanaceae in general, so potatoes, tomatoes, peppers. This race in Biovar is not one that occurs in the U.S., and it is a major concern from a national perspective. And unfortunately, it came into the country on a variety of drains from South America, and it came to several locations. Unfortunately, one of them was Minnesota. So we ended up collecting and destroying tens of thousands of geraniums across the state, particularly from one grower who was unfortunate enough to get these contaminated geraniums. USDA ended up declaring that eradication was successful through the collection and destruction of plants, so that was good. But that was a pretty major undertaking, you had to get those plants and destroy them. A few other things that have come up over the past year or so, the elongate hemlock scale, that's something that moves on Christmas trees. It's not known to be present in Minnesota. We're trying to keep it out. And then a few things that have been found recently, European chafer, a little leaf beetle, viburnum leaf beetle. These are examples of things that kind of move under the radar. And when they're found, kind of the only tool we have is to keep the best updates we can on where they are for people to take you know, actions for the landscapes, but it's really pretty much impossible to keep them from spreading. Next slide, please. I just wanted to mention emerald ash borer. So recently, emerald ash borer was deregulated at the federal level. That means that USDA is no longer taking any action to limit the state-to-state spread of emerald ash borer. From a national perspective, that makes sense. Emerald ash borer is across most of the natural ash range of the country. But in Minnesota, emerald ash borer is still a really big deal, and most of our ash is yet, as of yet, not affected. So we're maintaining regulation in Minnesota, and when USDA stepped out of that role, we're able to step into that role as a state. So we're taking over USDA's role in terms of limiting products that are coming into Minnesota that could carry emerald ash borer, and we're continuing to regulate it within the state as well. We have a long ways to go with emerald ash borer in Minnesota, and the more slowly we can keep it moving, the better off we're gonna be. Okay, next slide, which is my last one. Also wanted to mention gypsy moth. So this is kind of similar to emerald ash borer in that it's moving across the country. You can see the bright lights there and kind of an arc going down through Wisconsin. That is the advancing population front of gypsy moth. So it's been kind of marching across the country over the last 140 years and has been slowed down significantly by a coordinated effort by states and the federal government called Slow the Spread. Minnesota has been a participant in that for years, and it's helped to keep Minnesota free from gypsy moth. But the pressure is increasing. So our treatments, so when a new population pops up, we treat it and knock it out, and that keeps the population front moving more slowly, but our treatments are going up. So as in the coming years, this is gonna continue to be a bigger and bigger issue as that population front gets closer. And that is my last slide. So thank you, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Director Abrahamson. That's a good presentation. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes for questions. I see a hand up. Representative Hansen R., please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good job, Mr. Abrahamson. My question is about the Palmer Amaranth and the general fund request. I know we've had some LCCMR money also dedicated to that, but the problem with Palmer Amaranth is its resistance, and that resistance wasn't a naturally occurring thing. It occurred because it's become resistant to certain pesticides because of the overuse of those particular pesticides. And what I'm wondering is, shouldn't maybe the manufacturers of the chemicals who cause that overuse and resistance be responsible for the cleanup of the mess rather than the general fund taxpayers in Minnesota? So has there been any work done on trying to capture funds from the pesticide manufacturers for cleaning up the mess?
Director Abrahamson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. Not to my knowledge, Representative. It's worth noting that there certainly are populations of Palmer Amaranth that have herbicide resistance. They're not all herbicide resistant. And so anytime that we've had a population show up in Minnesota, that is, those are traits that we can have tested for. And so we have had a couple of sites where resistant varieties or resistant populations have shown up. We've been fortunate in that we've been finding these sites early enough that herbicides really have not been a big component of our management programs. Actually, fire, the flame torching sites where seed has been produced, and then also burning of sites has been one of the main management tools. And also some of these sites have been found early enough that ant pulling has also been a big component.
Great. Thank you. Representative Lippert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Abrahamson. You mentioned emerald ash borer, and this is clearly a key issue for our cities, both large and small, and for northern forests. Just curious if we can talk a little bit more about some of the main things we can be doing to slow the spread as much as possible. It seems like that's just a key strategy we need to be focused on right now.
Mr. Abrahamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert. Yeah, I agree. Slowing the spread is number one. And so that's where we've tried to remain aggressive here with the regulations and outreach messages. I think it's really important that we keep the messaging out there about firewood, because my experience has been that it needs to be something that people hear continuously. I think the other thing that we've done a good job with and need to continue at is working in communities. Communities are the first place that emerald ash borer gets to, and it's the first place that it spreads from. So we really need to keep hammering on getting work done in the communities, and that's going to help to keep it out of the forest, which is a very hard place to manage. So the longer we can keep working in communities and out of the forest, it's going to be a good thing.
Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Abrahamson, I'd like to go back for a second. Talk again about the invasive species program. A little bit confused, you had numbers up there, 225,000 or 450,000, and also talking about three new hires. Now, years back, we've talked about this, and I think it was the intent of a lot of us that any new funding would go directly to the counties to deal with invasive species in weed management, that type of thing. So could you explain the funding numbers again, and is that money gonna go toward new hiring, or will it go to the counties to help them in their battle against weeds?
Director Abrahamson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. Yeah, very good question. So that money we're asking is for operating money at the Department of Ag. We are in the current biennium. We have money from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund that has been used to fund the local government grant programs. Our intention is to go back again to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund to seek grant money to provide for local governments again. I think that is a really critical thing that we need to keep going. I think what our experience has been, though, that it isn't necessarily enough just to give the counties or local governments the money. If we can also provide them with some coordinating efforts, some staff expertise, that seems to go a long way towards making good use of those funds. And so that's where those regional people have come really into handy. They are temporary positions is what we hired in the past biennium. But they're the ones that are really driving those big increases in the acres that we're detecting and acres that we're getting managed. So I do feel like, yes, the local government grants are pretty critical, but we also feel like we need to provide them with some support to go along with them.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Nelson N., please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I got a question on the Wolf Depredation Fund, and an elk is included in that. And I'm just kind of wondering, are things going to be fairly stable with that? You know, now the control and management is under Minnesota and not the USDA. How are things changing there? And are you working with the DNR on kind of implementing the Wolf Plan that was almost 20 years ago now that it was adopted and put into place?
Mr. Abrahamson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. It's hard to say, I guess, with the numbers. They do fluctuate from year to year in terms of the numbers of claims and the amount of dollars claimed for wolf depredation. We've been on a bit of a downward trajectory over the last few years. I like to think that our grant program for preventative measures is having something to do with it, but, we're who knows? So our role in wolves is pretty small in terms of the wolf management plan. We've sat in on those meetings in terms of like just being aware of what's going on, but really our involvement is just limited to the claim program and then the kind of related grant program. We do work very closely, though, with DNR and also USDA APHIS Wildlife Services in terms of not only they're the ones that are typically evaluating the claims, but then they also help us out by, you know, consulting on the grant program as well.
Thank you. We have time for one more quick question to Director Abrahamson. Representative Lewick, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general comment. With respect to the number of wolves that have been taken because they've been killing livestock or family pets, that number's stayed fairly stable. In fact, there's a new annual report, calendar year report, just issued by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or by USDA Wildlife Services. I'll distribute that to everybody. That'll give you a perspective for those of you that are not familiar with this. It actually predates most of the wolf management programs in Minnesota, and it works with the elk program. I guess one of the questions I have, is the Department of Ag following the suggestions that we need to reintroduce elk over there in northern Aiken County and Carlton County? There's been discussion on and off. I know we don't grow a lot of wheat over there like we do up in the Northwest, and the elk will destroy a wheat field in a heartbeat, but I know we do some dairying and other stuff, and I don't know, I suspect they would rip a cornfield to shreds in a heartbeat too, but is the Department of Ag following that at all?
Mr. Abrahamson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not been involved, so I can't comment to that.
Okay, thank you. I'm certain we'll be looking into that issue further as committee work continues. Thank you, Representative Lewick. Next up, we have Josh Stamper. He's the division director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. Mr. Stamper, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. My name is Josh Stamper. I'm the division director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Program. We commonly condense that down to PFMD. And I'd just like to take time to go through our PowerPoint presentation, walk you through some of our programs, and then look at some of the budget impacts that our program has had over the years, but also look at and discuss some of our future needs that we're seeing with the introduction of some new disruptive technologies and the ability to better serve different citizens of Minnesota. Ms. Conley, may I have the next slide? Thank you. Dedicated accounts and that are funded through fees on the sale of agricultural chemicals make up the lion's share of our budget. We have a small amount of federal dollars that come in through a cooperative agreement with EPA. We had some carry forward clean water legacy money and dollars that go into the remediation fund make up the rest of PFMD's base budget. Next slide, Ms. Conley. Pesticides and fertilizer regulation accounts for the lion's share of our activities. Pesticides, and you can't quite see it because of the menu, but when we look at the top 12 pesticide active ingredients broken out by sales, we tend to lump all agricultural chemicals together, but when we actually look at products that make pesticidal claims and that we register as pesticides, a large portion of them are disinfectants and wood treatment products. In addition to the just day-to-day regulation of pesticides and fertilizers, we're also one of the few states that has full and significant charges for the protection of both ground and surface water. We also offer emergency response services. We conduct administrative oversight of cleanups. And then we also have a funding mechanism to help reimburse folks who come in and report and then subsequently clean up spills of these chemicals. We also have a significant waste pesticide collection program that to date, since 1990, we have disposed of a little over 9 million pounds of pesticides. PFMD is also the home of the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program, and this is a voluntary opportunity for growers to take the implementing conservation and farm management practices that really focus on protecting Minnesota's water quality. And in exchange for this certification, certified farms receive a period of regulatory certainty of 10 years. Next slide, please, Ms. Conlon. PFMD really focuses to work with our regulated clientele, and often this is farmers, regulated industry, and other interested parties. And we try to work with them on the front end as much as possible. We want the expectations to be clear. We go to great lengths to make sure that there is no gotcha enforcement. We have a diverse workforce. Right now, currently, we have about 110 employees. 40% of them are spread out in greater Minnesota. Many of the rest of them are in here in the Twin Cities. Many of them have graduate degrees. Many of them come from farm and agricultural backgrounds. Some of them still continue to farm. And the PFMD budget, when we look at all of the different revenue streams, is significant. It's about $30 million a year. But a large part of that is also pass-through dollars to other local units of government. Next slide, please, Ms. Conlon. Our regulatory activities is really focused on the registration of different products. Currently, we register about 14,700 different products within the state. Our next major activity is the licensing of certified pesticide applicators. We currently license about 30,000 applicators, whether they are licensed as commercial or non-commercial applicators, or if they are certified as private applicators, so someone who's making a pesticide application on their farm or agricultural enterprise. Each year, we respond to between 100 and 200 complaints. This year, I think we had about 220 pesticide misuse complaints. If they are submitted within the statutory guidelines, we respond and investigate every one of those complaints that has merit. We also conduct extensive facility inspections. We also respond to emergencies. So say that a truck hauling some sort of agricultural chemical tips over. We work closely with our sister agencies through the duty officer to respond to that and to make sure that whoever is responding to that understands what the, you know, once the situation is contained, how do we figure out the best way to consolidate that spill and then to clean it up in the most timely and cost-effective way possible. We also are responsible for the regulation of anhydrous ammonia. This is the most cost-effective form of nitrogen, but it is also a condensed gas and represents a risk. So we spend a lot of time working with regulated industry to make sure that their use and storage and management of anhydrous ammonia does not present a risk to human health or the environment. And I would also take a moment there's a pesticide complaint timeline here. This year we were audited. There was a pesticide regulatory audit through the Office of the Legislative Auditor. One of the things that they brought to our attention in our complaint timeline that we distribute to folks who may have pesticide misuse complaints is in the middle blue dot down at the bottom, there's a 1 to 4 month turnaround time on our sample analysis through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture lab. That little dot used to be 2 to 3 weeks. And one of the challenges that we've run into is that as a lot of our equipment has started to age, It's been much more difficult to keep that running. And so later on in this presentation, I'll be walking y'all through what some of our increases would entail and how to address that. Next slide, Ms. Connell. Our incident response program breaks out into several different categories. We have emergency site cleanups, we have long-term site cleanups, we have voluntary site cleanups. And this is really these are usually the definition of point sources of contamination. We need to clean these sites up so that they don't contribute to the degradation of groundwater. We've been able to do this over the years. We've cleaned up 900 sites to date that have fallen into emergency, long-term, or voluntary cleanups. And we have dispersed about $50 million through our ACRA program, which is our Ag Chemical Response and Reimbursement Account. That has really been instrumental in making sure that we get these sites cleaned up so that they do not continue to contribute to the degradation of Minnesota's groundwater. PFMD also has Superfund authority. We currently have 5 active Superfund sites, and we have closed 4 previous Superfund locations. Our incident response activities, we believe, is absolutely a flagship program, and everyone in Minnesota benefits from these. Next slide, please. Our non-point source activities, we are responsible for addressing non-point source impacts to groundwater from nitrate and fertilizer. I'll elaborate a little bit more on these activities in a moment. We also work with non-point source impacts to surface water and groundwater for pesticides. We also work with other health and environmental risks that are associated with pesticides, and then also more broadly, the water quality monitoring for pesticides and for nitrate. Next slide, please. Our fertilizer non-point activities are really focused on a lot of our activities within the nitrogen fertilizer management plan, and then the subsequent groundwater protection rule to protect groundwater. We also develop fertilizer best management practices in conjunction with the University of Minnesota. We provide technical assistance to local units of governments, SWCDs, and the like, to address some of these surface water impairments. And then we also fund priority research through a lot of our activities with the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. We also are the only certifier in the country for manure testing labs. There's been a lot of interest, resurging interest in the value that manure presents, both to the cattlemen, or the livestock producers maybe producing manure, and also the row crop producers that see real value in those products. And our goal is to make sure that the labs that are offering these testing and certification, that everybody's, you know, at least making a B in their analysis of these products. Okay. Our non-point source programs for pesticides are primarily focused on the our pesticide management plan to protect Minnesota's water resources. And as a function of that, we've developed 24 different best management practices related to pesticides. 15 of those BMPs are specific to certain active ingredients within the pesticidal claims. And then 6 of those BMPs are also focused directly on pollinator best management practices. And so these are things that will help promote and protect pollinators. We assist a lot of our sister agencies on pesticide issues. We work closely with the Departments of Health, Pollution Control, and the DNR, as well as some of the other organizations that may have pesticide issues. Next slide, please. And our non-point source programs are also heavily dependent. I would say that the foundation, a lot of our non-point source programs are rest upon the foundation of a lot of our water quality monitoring activities. We've been doing this for a long time. We've been monitoring Minnesota for over 25 years. We have edge of field and tile line monitoring. We conduct a lot of the more technical instrumentation for the Discovery Farms in Minnesota and their monitoring activities. We've also monitored private wells through our township testing program. And to date, we have evaluated over 30,000 private homeowner wells for the presence of nitrate, nitrogen, and also subsequently pesticides. We coordinate with other monitoring programs around the state. Every year we publish an annual monitoring report that's between 400 and 600 pages, and we analyze a significant number of samples. We run on the order of 120,000 analyses each year. So this water quality monitoring is really foundational for a lot of our charge to protect the environment from adverse impacts from agricultural chemicals. But it's also dependent significantly on having a world-class laboratory that allows us to run a lot of those analytes and to turn those samples around in a timely manner. Next slide, please. When we look at the PFMD budget from our dedicated accounts, these are fees that have specific earmarks. The pesticide regulatory account is a very significant component of this total budget breakdown. There's a little over $18 million that comes in each year through the pesticide regulatory account. Then we have our ACRA program. This is our kind of insurance for, program for cleanups that reimburses responsible parties up to 80% after the first $1,000 of the cleanup costs if there is a subsequent remedial, if there's a plan that's approved by our staff to make sure that this will be sufficient in cleaning everything up. So we think ACRA is a great program and we're really supportive of it. Our fertilizer fees account for about 12% of our total dedicated account budget at just under $5 million. Then we also have $3 million that goes into the AFRIC program. This is our agriculture or our fertilizer research program that looks at providing research to fund or to provide growers information about how to most effectively use fertilizer. MRLA projects. At about $3.1 million in the MRLA program. This is really focused on our Superfund cleanups. Then after that, we have about $3.16 million that's in our waste pesticide program. And most of this money goes into reimbursing local units of government that that partner with us on accepting waste pesticide programs through the household hazardous waste programs within their counties. If we do not have a cooperative agreement with some counties to have a that will accept agricultural chemicals at the household hazardous waste programs, we do offer every year site collections to take in waste pesticide and have that safely and appropriately disposed of. And then our general fund accounts for around 3% of our total budget. We get about $1.2 million in general fund each year. And then there's also some money that with our Superfund, that covers our Superfund administrative costs. And then we have some federal money that comes in through the EPA through our cooperative agreement. Next slide, Ms. Connell. And then lastly, this is just a breakout of the clean water component by appropriation. So our Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program accounts for about a third of our clean water fund dollars. Our nitrate in groundwater program, WO2, is right around 25% of our total clean water fund appropriation. And then Forever Green, which is entirely passed through to the University of Minnesota. And then we also have a technical assistance program, and that technical assistance program is really responsible for a lot of the research and the development of tools that help address a lot of our non-point source concerns about agriculture and making sure that we're protecting surface and groundwater. We have a monitoring well testing program. We also pass through about $270,000 every year to the University of Minnesota for their irrigation extension specialist position. We have the WO1 pesticide non-point program, which accounts for about 4% of those dollars. And then we have the Ag BMP program, and then also the research data, which is a database of research projects that are germane to Minnesota and a lot of the non-point source protection activities. So next slide, Ms. Conley. We do have two budget requests this year. The first one is to increase the pesticide fee to fund the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's lab, and then also to provide resources to better focus some of our pesticide outreach program on urban and domestic users of pesticides. As you heard me say early on, there's a significant amount of pesticides that actually don't fit with what we typically think of as pesticides. Many of them are disinfectants. Many of them are, you know, products that you're going to have in the home. Many people may keep them underneath their kitchen cupboard. And when we think about the risks to children, to people who may not be able to read, when you look at a lot of the risk that you have within your home, a lot of that is going to be focused on those chemicals that may not necessarily be stored well. And when we look at the number of pesticide poisonings, this is where we see a group of folks that has not really effectively been reached. Most of the pesticide poisonings happen when kids get underneath the kitchen sink and get into these products. We do think that we do need to provide more services and maybe a more focused outreach campaign towards schools to help folks understand the risk that's associated with these products. So that's going to be one component of it. But the stable source of revenue to replace a lot of our high-cost analytical instruments that are used in our laboratory is a significant component of this. And then also one of the outcomes of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's pesticide regulatory audit was the Office of the Legislative Auditor recommended for us to pursue the ability to test for three additional products. And in consultation with the laboratory, we just do not currently have the instrumentation or the expertise to be able to effectively quantify the concentrations of those additional recommended products. We've been doing the best we can with what we have, but if we want to go after some of these additional products, it's going to require more resources. And then next slide, Ms. Conway. Thank you. And then our last one is a general fund request. And I'm very lucky to have my associate, Brad Jordahl Redland, with me today. And he can answer any specific questions about this. But Climate Smart Farms program would be run through the Minnesota, the MDA's Ag Water Quality Certification Program. This is a state and federal partnership between the state, USDA, EPA, and private industry. It's the first of its kind program. I was really blessed to have the opportunity to work with this program in its very beginning stages. I'm a huge advocate of it. I think that this is an excellent opportunity to provide the farm community with a way to be engaged in having 5 years a bridge payment program through farmers that are already certified through this program. Mr. Redland celebrated the milestone this last week of having 1,000 farms certified, and they're well over 750,000 acres. So we're really excited to see this, and we think that the Climate Smart Farm endorsement would be another great opportunity to talk about how do we engage the farm community in climate mitigation practices. So with that, Chair Sundin, I'll stand for any questions, and also have Mr. Redland on deck.
Thank you very much, Director Stamper. We have a couple of questions. We have time for a couple of them, so it'll work out really good. Representative Hansen R.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two quick questions. One is, Mr. Stamper, are you able to analyze for the various neonicotinoid products, and are you able to analyze for dicamba and its breakdown products so that you have the ability to do enforcement? That's the first question.
Director Stamper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. Yes, we are able to analyze for neonicotinoids. When it comes to dicamba, we can analyze for dicamba. The challenge with dicamba is that soybeans are so, so very sensitive to dicamba that it only takes a very minor amount to cause physical symptomology. We are not currently very successful in finding dicamba in the course of our investigations, because many times by the time we're able to get out, when people see the damage, they talk to their neighbors, they make the call, there's nothing to find. Currently, we're analyzing to the level of 3 to 10 parts per billion. We could go down to 1 part per billion, but that would represent a significant challenge in our analytical activities.
Is there a follow-up, Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Mr. Stamper, kind of the boilerplate regulatory authority the Commissioner of Agriculture has, I think it's both in 18B and in 18C, is to prevent unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. And it would seem that there are some climate impacts that may not have been considered back in 1989 when the pesticide law went through its major change, specifically on anhydrous ammonia and the production and use of anhydrous ammonia. Has the department looked at any of the climate impacts for the production of fertilizer and its use in our environment? And is it unreasonable?
Director Stamper, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin, Representative Hansen. The production of nitrogen fertilizer is predicated off of an energy intensive process where you're cracking natural gas. Our atmosphere is made up of 78% atmospheric nitrogen, N2. It has a trivalent bond. So if you think about each of my hands being N, it's got this really strong trivalent bond that takes an immense amount of energy and pressure to break that trivalent bond. In the production of anhydrous ammonia, we have a catalyst, we have high temperatures, we have pressure, we break that N2 bond, and then all of a sudden hydrogens will latch on to this. So we have NH3. NH3 represents that without, meaning anhydrous, you know, so ammonia without water. That in and of itself is a significant consumption of natural resources. Whether or not the actual production of that cracking that gas, whether or not that is actually an adverse impact on the environment, I cannot speak to, and I think that goes well beyond 18C.
Representative Hansen?
We'll continue the discussion later.
Thank you. Representative Lippert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Stamper. I'm just curious about the Climate Smart Farms program and if there's an acre goal with kind of connected with this new certification. Sounds like 750,000 acres are enrolled so far with Ag Water Quality Certification Program. Is there an additional acre goal with this new certification?
Director Stamper, please.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lippert, I'd like to phone a friend and bring in Bradley Jordan already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We are at currently 710,000 acres overall certified ground.
Can you please identify yourself for the tape?
Sorry. For the record, my name is Brad Jordahl Redland. I'm the program manager for Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Minnesota Agriculture Water Quality Certification Program.
Thank you.
The Climate Smart Farms project is a proposal we've made for a new Climate Smart Farm endorsement process that we have for certified farms who want to be recognized and pursue climate activities on their farms, both for the adaptation of their own operation to handle the crazy weather, as well as the mitigation opportunities they can provide for the rest of society and should be receiving some value for, which kind of undergirds this Climate Smart Farms project that we're proposing, so that farms who obtain this climate endorsement from us can receive an incentive investment that on a limited time basis, a maximum of 5 years is our proposal, no longer than FY22 to FY26, so that they can begin really kind of educating themselves as well as physically structuring their farm to participate in climate markets as they mature and become viable in their region, in the state, in the nation. So the Climate Smart Farms project is, rather than necessarily a per acre goal, it's just an opportunity to build knowledge throughout agriculture system, certainly through the participants in our program, and kind of prepare the landscape for a private marketplace that will come in and provide the alternative revenue stream or additional revenue stream that these markets promise for growers and that we hope to see our growers realize.
Thank you. Is there a follow-up, Representative Blippert?
No, that was helpful, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lewick, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question on laboratory equipment requirements. Good concern here. Could you give us a little better perspective on, are you deficient in the ability to do sampling relative to things found under the sink in the average, particularly rural home? And what relationship do you have with other labs, both government and private? That's a little bit of an area where the Department of Ag historically has not had a huge role, but we do understand that there's a huge, huge amount of, quote, pesticide and other hazardous things under the kitchen sink in the average home that most people don't realize. So,
Director Stamper?
Thank you, Representative Sundin. Representative Lewick, when it comes to things that you're going to encounter under the sink, that's not really what our concern is in monitoring. Our concern in monitoring is really focused on the high use products that are likely to end up, you know, that are water soluble or likely to end up in ground or surface water. They're products that we use a lot of. And historically, we've only had very narrow spectrums that we can analyze for. It's difficult for us to analyze for a broad suite of different products. So to put it in perspective, you know, for an average row crop producer, if we look at the FinBin data from the Minnesota Farm Business Management Program, which looks at a lot of the costs, the cost of this, of what our fee increase would pencil out to, is at about 11 cents an acre. That's what the fee would cost to go to continue to provide analysis for broad suite of these different products that we tend to we know can present a risk. Historically, we haven't had a lot of different products. There's less than a half a dozen different products that we designate as common detection. And they tend to be products that are water soluble and somewhat persistent. But our legislative audit that was released in March identified three active ingredients. One of them is metam sodium that we don't have the capacity to analyze for, and metam sodium was in that top 12 list. And the Office of the Legislative Auditor said that this, you know, one is that it's classified as toxic, and there's a lot of it sold and a lot of it used. And their recommendation to us was you guys should figure out a way to start monitoring for this. And with the current instrumentation that we have and the staff expertise, we cannot meet that directive.
So just a quick follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair, that particular item, let's go back to what I really asked about. Is that under the sink or in the field or both?
That's in the field.
Denver.
Okay, so then I can take away that while you've mentioned items under the sink, that's clearly not a major focus relative to your needs in the analytical lab.
Mr. Stamper.
You're correct. That was a separate, that's a line item in our budget change item. We're trying to address the fact that most of our pesticide poisonings are occurring in homes. We believe that because of the fact that we have such a strong certification and education program, a lot of our risks of negative adverse effects to human health is a function of kids getting stuff under the sink.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Stamper. Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, Mr. Stamper, good to see you. With the state pushing back the deadline for the spraying of dicamba this coming year, do you anticipate any changes in the licensing for applicators, or what changes in the label should they be aware of when they get ready to spray dicamba this coming year?
Mr. Stamper, please.
Chair Sundin, Representative Anderson, that's a wonderful question. I'm glad you asked it. When we look at how our approach is going to be focused on dicamba in the 2021 growing season, we are very much focused on education initially. And our education message is simple. You need to talk to your neighbors. You want to use this product to make sure that your use of this technology is going to be in agreement with their use of technology. As an applicator, you will be required to fully fill out all of the record keeping that is required on this label. This label is extensive. It can be extremely challenging to follow due to the fact that there's a lot of restrictions on this label. So we've spent some time with the dicamba training. We continue to have, I believe we have over 13,000 private applicators that are certified to use restricted use products. And you do have to be certified either as a commercial applicator or as a private applicator to use restricted use products. But we're going to really focus on the record keeping component of this in our investigations. A lot of our, we thought June 20th cutoff date was going to be just great. But we had a very disruptive June, atmospherically and legally. And I think there were some folks who kind of lost their heads a little bit and went out and made some applications in a manner that might have been a little bit reckless. So we had a lot of complaints. We actually had more complaints for investigations last year than we did in 2017. And that was problematic. And our goal now is to say that we have a regulatory structure that is there, it's sufficient, but we've got to have folks follow the law and they've got to follow the label. And it's our intention to enforce the label.
Thank you.
We have time for one. Representative Anderson, you had a follow-up? Okay. Thank you. We have time for one quick question from Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be really quick. So I don't apply dicamba because I live in the metro, but I remember years ago, back at the University of Minnesota, I think it was Dr. Behrens who talked about the volatility, the extreme volatility of dicamba. Has that changed since the late 70s, early 80s going forward? Or is it still just as volatile as it was at that time?
Stanford.
Chair Sundin, Representative Claiborne. Auxin herbicides are often volatile. It's not just dicamba, there's 2,4-D. And these plant growth regulators have the capacity to get up and move around. The registrants, when they introduced this product, said this was a much lower volatility version of that. The reality of it is that soybeans are one of the most sensitive crops to dicamba. And it's not so much that it moves around so much, it's just that soybeans are so incredibly sensitive to it. And that's one of the reasons why most of our complaints, but not all of them, have been from soybeans. And dicamba and the class of auxin herbicides is not unique to this, but we saw it the most because of the fact that we grow a lot of soybeans in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Stamper. This has been a great discussion. We'll go on to our next segment with Gary Horvath. He's the director of the Laboratory Services. Mr. Horvath, please.
Hi. Can I get my slides up, please? Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gary Horvath. I'm director of the Lab Services Division here at the Department of Agriculture. Next slide. And our budget's around $20 million, and you can see about half that is general fund. Then we have ag fund, dedicated funds, such as PFMD. Josh described some of that. And then the rest is federal grants that we receive for various programs, and I'll talk about that as we move on. Next slide, please. So before we get going, I just want to point out that the high quality labs, a cornerstone of technical programs, like you just heard described by our two previous presenters, whether they're regulatory, monitoring, or research in nature. Next slide. So we're the lab at the department, and we have our major customers are listed here. So we do testing of dairy and meat for Dairy and Meat Inspection Division. We do food feed safety divisions, food safety samples from outbreaks and such. You just heard Josh talk about PFMD's monitoring and enforcement work. We do pesticide and inorganic testing for them. And then Mark, Plant Protection Division, our seed lab, supports that activity and some plant pathogen work. We also are the DNR's lab for eco and water resources. We do all the stream and lake monitoring for the limnological components of interest to measure health of the waters. And we also do some other work, which I'll describe a little bit later. We do get a bit of grant money via PFMD through the EPA for groundwater and enforcement work. And then we also have grants from the USDA and FDA for the Food Emergency Response Network, which I'll describe. So the lab assists in regulatory enforcement monitoring. We develop methods that are specific to the needs of our customers. Maybe they're looking at something that is not on the radar nationally, so we'll develop methods to meet their needs. Emerging issues, produce methodology that supports, we produce methodology that supports potential regulation for monitoring. We do routine testing for some established methods. And then we also provide data that's legally and scientifically defensible. And we spend a bit of time on that. If we move to the next slide. So we are accredited to the ISO 17025 standard, which is a standard for testing labs to meet the quality objectives of our customers. We got accredited in 2012. We're continuing to look at expanding our scope of accreditation to other tests as deemed important by the customer. And we recently successfully were accredited to the revised standard, which made some significant changes, and we successfully were accredited to that. Next slide. And so we are accredited for both a biological scope of testing and a chemical scope of testing, and those are on the A2LA website for anyone to look at. Next slide. And so, you know, why is this important? We spend a lot of time. We have a quality committee. We work with the customers up front, defining expectations and data quality needs, because this installs confidence in integrity and validity of the data that's used by the various programs, gives program managers confidence in the data. The regulated community should have faith in our ability to produce fair and precise data for which they're being held to by the regulators. And we also are working with the feds to make data acceptable by federal and other agencies to try and expand the overall federal approach to food safety and such. Next slide. So we produce high quality data. Fit for purpose means it meets the specific goals and objectives of the program. You heard Josh talk about pesticides, and many of the pesticides we monitor for are not nationally looked at. So we can produce test results for, you know, what the customer needs. And, you know, data is generally being scrutinized more by the regulated community and the general public. You know, are we looking for the right things? Are we looking low enough? Is our methodology accurate? So we have to spend a lot of time on our quality system. And then, you know, we do occasionally get challenged on our data, and we've successfully defended our data, and it's important that we're correct. We view ourselves as being the lab of kind of a referee type lab. At the end of the day, we have to be accurate. Next slide. So we contribute to Healthy Minnesota. We look at pathogen analysis in food, compositional chemistry. You know, what is the makeup? What are the producers claiming versus what's out there in the marketplace? We look at residues. Toxins occasionally come along, either natural or man-made. We do species identification. We support the pasteurized milk ordinance, which allows for interstate shipment of milk, other compliance testing, and nutritional labeling verification. Again, what's on the label? Is it truly that? We get some consumer complaints and such, so we have that capability. Next slide. Talked about our federal grant money. We have a large grant with the FDA and also with the USDA under the Food Emergency Response Network. We originally started after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. We look at select agents. Those are chemicals that could be used. They're highly toxic. And if introduced into the food, interjected into the food chain or water, could kill a lot of people. They're very toxic. So we started work back then, and it's kind of morphed into that, plus responding to nationwide outbreaks involving pathogens and other chemical agents, such as the melamine in milk. And we were involved with the Gulf Horizon oil spill and contamination in the food chain. So it's a program that does a lot of good for the food chain, and we're pretty active in that and have been since the start. Next slide, please. And we contribute to a clean environment. We're doing, as Josh said, we're monitoring inorganic nutrients. We do this both for the DNR and PFMD, pesticides and water, both surface and ground. We are the main pest site enforcement lab. We work on the dicamba situation, human exposure, pesticide drift, illegal dumping, all those types of events we work on, and then compositional chemistry of feed and fertilizer. Next slide. And then the DNR, we do the hatchery NPDS, which is their National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, which are, is the federal discharge requirements by EPA for their hatcheries, so they can dump the effluent from the hatcheries into natural waters. We do nutrients, mineral metals analysis. Again, I mentioned before, lakes and stream surveys. We do get involved with chemical spills and fish kills. We have members on a team that work with the DNR. And we also do the fish consumption advisories for mercury and PCB analysis. Next slide. And then we contribute to a healthy ag economy. We do label verification of ingredients for seed, feed, and food. We support phytosanitary certificates for the plant protection division and do some plant pathogen detection. Next slide. And we do have a governor's budget recommendation. As you know, last biennium, we had asked for and received from this body and the legislature as a whole, we created a capital equipment appropriation, which we had been trying to establish for many years. And, you know, we're very grateful to get that. And we are asking to boost that an additional $66,000 a year for the next biennium. And this would allow us to replace some fully depreciated equipment in our microbiology, chemtox, and plant seed analysis units. Our main use of general fund, aside from rent and some administrative stuff, is supporting food safety testing, since they don't have a dedicated fund. So we set aside a large chunk of our general fund for that. And the equipment you see here mostly support microbiology testing for food pathogens and some chemical testing for feed or for food. And so we feel that this, combined with our current appropriation of $225 a year, would allow us to buy this equipment and put us in pretty good stead. You heard, so let's go to the next slide. So this is the state of our capital equipment, which is we've struggled with for a number of years and why we wanted the establishment of the fund. Most 67% of our capital equipment, and that is equipment over $30,000, is fully depreciated. Now, you know, some of it, you know, it's still working, but one of the challenges we have is the vendors. We have two big instruments that the vendor has informed us they're no longer going to support. What that means is there may not be spare parts anymore. Oftentimes these pieces of equipment have run with sophisticated software, and we get into situations where the operating system, it gets frozen in time as Microsoft moves along. The software gets frozen on an old version. We've had to isolate equipment for security reasons, and the machine just becomes obsolete, even though the analytical portion of the machine may work. So we have a large depreciated value in our equipment, and that's the current status. Next slide. So this shows with our current appropriation, which for the next biennium is at 225, shows 73 and 27. With the increased appropriation, you can see that moves at a couple percent. So like I said, it mostly is for the equipment that supports general fund activity or some of the lesser, smaller programs that we have. The lion's share of the fully depreciated equipment, unfortunately, is supports the PFMD division, which relies on mass spectrometers and very expensive to own and maintain. And so the next slide shows that if we get the PFMD's fee increase and we get the money, that kind of flips the whole situation around, puts us in pretty good stead. We do have, still have 31% fully depreciated. We have to carry a large inventory of things that, you know, we have a broad responsibility to respond to anything that comes down the pike. So we have a lot of equipment. A lot of the items aren't used very frequently, but it's kind of like, I always like to use the analogy of a firehouse with a big hook and ladder. Most fires are one and two story homes. You never really need to pull it out. But when you do need it, you better have it. And so we have a lot of equipment, very broad capability. We don't have a real deep capacity on those things. So we replace those as we feel we need to. And we have some latitude. We're hoping with, you know, as we move forward with this new capital fund, we'll have that latitude to make strategic investments there. But the stuff that you see here, the 69% that we'll get with the fee increase, replaces really critical instrumentation for water monitoring and enforcement. And so that's kind of where I'm at, and I'll gladly stand for questions. I think you're muted.
Any questions for Mr. Horvath? Okay, hearing none. Just a reminder, besides our regular committee work on Wednesday, we'll be having a joint hearing with the Natural Resources Committee. So keep an eye on your emails, and we'll see you on Wednesday. We're adjourned. Thank you.